This is the Publix Radio. You're listening to The Weekly Catch. I'm Luis Hernandez. 1 in 3 Rhode Islanders depend on Medicaid. That's why there's grave concern if the Senate passes Trump's budget plan, which includes massive cuts to the health insurance program. We'll talk about what's at stake with Rhode Island Representative Gabe Amo. Also, RIPTA officials are facing a $33 million deficit. Lawmakers in the General Assembly need to pass a budget with the money to fill that gap or cut bus lines and schedules throughout the state. And we speak with Westerly documentarian Hillary Steinman, who tackles the history of the Americans with Disabilities Act in her new film, Change, Not Charity. All that and more on this episode of The Weekly Catch. Last week, the U.S. House approved President Trump's budget package, a spending plan that would, among other things, dramatically cut funding to programs like Medicaid and Supplemental Nutrition Assistance, better known as SNAP. If implemented, the cuts could have a significant impact on Rhode Island families that are struggling financially and rely on these programs for support. Joining me now is Rhode Island Congressman Gabe Amo. Congressman, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
What parts of President Trump's spending package concern you most?
Well, first and foremost, this is really a dramatic redistribution of wealth. And what we'll see at the end of the day is tax cuts for and tax giveaways, frankly, for those who are at the top of the income ladder. And the most dramatic impacts we'll have on the programs like Medicaid and SNAP. Nearly 40,000 Rhode Islanders will lose their health insurance over the course of the next 10 years if this plan is moved on by the Senate as is and signed by President Trump. And that's 29,000 Rhode Islanders losing Medicaid coverage, 11,000 Rhode Islanders losing coverage through the Affordable Care Act, and not to mention all of the dramatic impacts on the healthcare system writ large, payments to Medicaid providers across the country, hurting community health centers, folks with disabilities. So there is a lot of impact, and that's just the Medicaid side. I haven't even mentioned SNAP, which is going to hurt potentially 18,000 Rhode Islanders in the first congressional district. So this is really problematic for me and something that I am hoping that we're able to stop and avert totally.
Well, I'm wondering at this point, now that it's in the hands of the Senate, what can Rhode Island's congressional delegation do? What is the plan, especially by Democrats at this point?
Well, look, the plan has got to be a consistent articulation of values and a clear contrast. Certainly here in Rhode Island, I have a strong sense of where people stand. Now, in red states and in districts that are marginal, we still have to raise our voices because while the Senate acts on this, there is not a consensus from Republicans on how to move forward. So we have to continue to amplify our voices in every setting possible, make sure that those senators know that their constituents will not be satisfied if they move forward with this legislation. And if they do ultimately make any changes in the Senate, it will have to come back to the House. And that gives us another opportunity to raise the volume, raise the temperature on those Republican members who are supportive of this legislation.
Now, look, I know it's the Senate, but, some Senate Republicans have expressed dissatisfaction with the package. What parts of the bill do you think Republicans are willing to negotiate?
Well, look, I have no crystal ball into the world of Republicans, but I will tell you this. There is not a broad consensus on their side of the aisle for a few reasons. One, if you're a fiscal hawk, this will drive up deficits to the tune of $4 trillion per year. And that is fiscally irresponsible, only driving up deficits to give tax breaks to the wealthy few. So I think that's inconsistent with those values. Similarly, there are Republicans like Senator Josh Hawley from Missouri who have said cutting Medicaid would be a politically unpalatable thing and bad for their constituents. So there are a few different angles to cut of this. But this is a very partisan process. Reconciliation by nature is so that you can overcome the filibuster. So there is not really a desire for them to, for Republicans to negotiate with Democrats on this. They want to drive forth this, you know, big partisan, ugly bill.
The budget includes a 24% cut to the budget for NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And this comes after the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, cut hundreds of NOAA workers. And this is all happening as we're entering hurricane season. What could be in the implications for this?
Well, I'm very, very concerned about cuts to NOAA. I serve on the subcommittee of the environment on the Science, Space, and Technology Committee, where I'm the top Democrat. And I had a recently fired climate scientist come to an oversight meeting because with only Democrats, because Republicans canceled the meeting. They did not want to talk about the implications of DOGE and their arbitrary terminations. What this will mean is we will be less safe. NOAA, the National Weather Service, the predictive element of their work to help us anticipate storms in what is been told will be a very active hurricane season. It puts us at a real position of peril. Moreover, FEMA has been gutted as well, with many forced early retirements and reductions in force that will make us less safe in the aftermath of a storm, while we are similarly less safe in preparation for a storm. That is a terrible mix.
We're barely 5 months into Trump's second term, and already we've heard from hundreds of scholars who are saying that the U.S. is heading swiftly towards authoritarianism, and some are not happy with the Democrats' response. What's your take on that?
Well, look, I think this has been an unprecedented moment. There are generally norms, regardless of what party takes over the White House, a real set of appreciation for our practices of democracy. This is not common. And so I think we have to be responsive in every single way possible. There is no one perfect plan, strategy, or set of actions that, you know, perfectly solved for this, because we've never seen this before. And so I'm fully understanding of constituents and people across the country who say they want to see more. And we will do more in every venue and every opportunity that I have personally. I will work towards that and work in concert with my colleagues in the Congress to say that the abuses that we've seen, especially the corruption, right, the blatant in our faces corruption, the enrichment of Trump specifically and his allies, that can't go on, and we have to have our courts continue in their judgments exercise their power of the judicial branch as well. But we're all in this together to make sure that our country moves forward and does not fall back into the concerns that are articulated by historians and other observers of the democratic process.
I've been speaking with Rhode Island Congressman Gabe Amo. Congressman, it's always a pleasure. I appreciate the time.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be back with more from the Weekly Catch after this break. This is the Public Radio. I'm Luis Hernandez. You're listening to the Weekly Catch. Our political reporter, Ian Donis, joins me now to break down the week in Rhode Island politics. Ian, it's always a pleasure.
Good to be with you, Lewis.
Ian, Rhode Island Attorney General Peter Nerona this week unveiled a series of steps aimed at addressing the state's healthcare crisis. Will these have much of an impact?
One aspect of Nerona's initiative involves a lawsuit against the nation's three largest pharmacy benefit managers. These act as middlemen between prescription makers and pharmacies. This is an issue that really bears watching because these are kind of powerful behind-the-scenes players. One of them is owned by OneSocket-based CVS. That is some high-stakes litigation right there. Other aspects of Nirona's plan include calling for raising Medicaid reimbursement. It's not immediately clear where the money will come from to do that. So some of these things sound like good ideas, but the details will have to be worked out over time.
All right. The Rhode Island House of Representatives had a sharp debate before voting this week to allow Providence to exceed a state law limiting tax increases to 4% a year. What is this all about?
Basically, Providence is between two poor choices. Either there could be layoffs in the city workforce and cuts of programs, or residents could pay more in taxes. Critics say that residents are already cash-strapped and that this would adversely affect Providence's least affluent residents in a difficult way. This is really a long-running problem in Providence where the city has struggled to get more revenue, and it shows how, with a tougher economic climate right now, there are no easy solutions for that.
Finally, we are approaching the end of the legislative session in a few weeks. What are the big issues?
Well, speaking of a tougher economic climate, the biggest thing the legislature does each year is pass a budget. We expect the legislature will wrap up by about June 20th, and before adjourning, lawmakers will pass a revised budget for the fiscal year starting July 1st. They make a series of changes to what Governor McKee proposed back in January. One other high-profile issue is legislation to ban new sales of so-called assault weapons. Critics say the legislation is overbroad and would ban a wide array of guns. Supporters say that this step is necessary to decrease the likelihood of a mass shooting in Rhode Island. The Senate Judiciary Committee is kind of the Bermuda Triangle of Rhode Island politics, so we will be following that process when it comes to a vote in the Judiciary Committee.
Thank you for the update, T, and always appreciate it.
Thank you, Lewis.
For more politics news, you could listen to the latest episode of Political Roundtable or read Ian's TGIF column out every Friday at 4 p.m. For years, the Rhode Island Public Transit Authority has faced significant financial struggles. Federal COVID funding has helped keep the agency afloat, but that money has dried up. Without additional funding to help close a projected $33 million gap, RIPTA may have to eliminate bus routes and lay off hundreds of employees. Advocates for mass transit in Rhode Island are pushing a series of bills in the General Assembly that would provide more state funding for RIPTA, but it's not clear if the proposals will garner support from top lawmakers. Here to talk more about what's at stake for public transportation in Rhode Island is Liza Birkin, Board President of the Providence Streets Coalition. Liza, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
What services would be impacted if RIPTA doesn't get the money?
RIPTA has not yet released exact estimates on what exactly that will be, but they have said with that budget gap, we're talking about 300 union jobs being cut and estimating about 25% of the service. And based on the 2023 projected service cuts, we can assume that things like all Sunday service could be eliminated, all late night, like vast reduction of service hours. So going from, you know, if one line runs till midnight, cutting that back till 9 p.m., all like supplemental school trips, summer beach service. So, and then specific reductions and elimination of routes, especially outside of the urban core. I think that the most likely thing to happen is that essentially, we would go from a statewide bus agency to a bus agency that really only serves the urban core and is not able to serve people out in our rural communities as much.
What's at stake for people who rely on these services?
It is very dire. RIPTA is a lifeline. These buses are lifelines for folks who cannot drive due to a disability, due to anyone who is younger than 16 and doesn't yet have their driver's license, and a lot of folks who are aging and can no longer drive, and then everyone in the state who cannot afford a car and for whom the rising cost of car ownership is such a significant burden. And people need to get to work. They need to get to work. They need to get to school. They need to get groceries, doctor's appointments, to get to church on Sundays. So the elimination and the reduction of service means isolation. It could mean unemployment. And our message to the General Assembly and to the public at large is that we really want to find a sustained funding source so that we can fix this problem once and for all.
RIPTA is not the only transit agency in the country right now that's experiencing these dire straits financially. Why do these organizations struggle to make enough money?
The fare box revenue, the amount of money that we collect from passengers, is and always has been a very tiny percentage of what is needed to move people in a public transit network. Since the creation of our highway system, we have funded transportation 80% to roads and bridges and 20% to public transit. And that is basically why when you go to Europe, when you go to Latin America, when you go to other, to Asia, to places that prioritize public transit more than we do in America, that is why their systems are so advanced and are so far behind. So it's not about making money. It's about investing in public goods like libraries and parks and roads. And in Rhode Island and across America, we have not been adequately funding public transit.
You recently testified at a House Finance Committee meeting in support of the legislation that provides the state funding for RIPTA. Tell us a little bit about that.
We have proposed 7 bills. We're pretty agnostic to which the General Assembly chooses. They're the policymakers, they're the lawmakers. And so we're putting our ideas forth. Some of those include changing the allocation of the gas tax and giving more of the existing gas tax to RIPTA. Another one is taking the existing sales tax that is charged on Uber and Lyft rides and giving that to RIPTA. One of them is asking large employers that have more than 500 employees, to help us subsidize transit for their employees as a pre-tax benefit. So we're putting forth a bunch of different creative ideas and saying, choose one or two.
Do you get the sense, though, that there's enough support for any of these?
I think there is a widening understanding that the consequences of service cuts and the consequences of these job losses is going to be very detrimental to our community and to our economy, to the climate. So I think that there is beginning to be an understanding from our leadership that we can't afford to let this happen.
The General Assembly provided RIPTA $15 million last year. And in exchange for that, the agency was supposed to complete an efficiency study by March, and it hasn't finished it yet. Do we know what's going on with that? Why is it taking so long?
Yeah, so I will say that this will be the 8th efficiency study that RIPTA has been either required or has completed since the early 2000s. I think RIPTA is probably the most studied agency at the state of Rhode Island, and I question the efficacy of why we really need to be doing this. I think it's an excuse, frankly, for just not deciding on a funding metric and moving forward.
But is there a concern, though, that, you know, because again, House Speaker Shikarchi expressed that frustration about the study not being done, that without it, they might just say no.
Yeah, I think all the advocates are frustrated about that. And we're here to say there's no need to wait. I think we need to come up with a solution, a funding solution now, and that can be adjusted later, depending the results of the survey.
Liza, even if the General Assembly fully funds RIPTA this year, that doesn't solve the problems the agency's facing. What does RIPTA have to do to be sustainable? Because the things you're talking about are a massive sea change that may not happen anytime soon. So how do we make this more sustainable, at least in the foreseeable future?
Absolutely. And what we're saying is that folks kind of see it as a chicken and egg situation. They're saying, you know, not enough people use RIPTA to justify investing in it. And we're saying we need to invest in it because what's different now compared to the past is we have a climate crisis. Transportation is the number one source of carbon emissions in our state. We have an affordability crisis. People cannot afford extra costs. That cost of housing is so high and the cost of groceries is so high. There are justifications for investing in our public transit system now that haven't been there before. And we're saying that if you invest in the frequency, in the operations, if we do things like build bus lanes, like building better transit shelters, but like making our buses move faster than cars and making the system affordable, convenient, and reliable to use, then people will use it. people will ride. That's what we see around the world. When you invest in a really great transit system, people use it and it becomes the backbone of the economy. It becomes a reason why corporations want to move to that place. So we have to inject some hormones into the chicken before it's going to lay some eggs.
Liza Birkin is the board president of the Providence Streets Coalition. Liza, I always appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more from the Weekly Catch after this break. This is the Weekly Catch. I'm Luis Hernandez, and it's time for Artscape. This year marks the 35th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, which protects people with disabilities from discrimination in areas such as employment, education, and public accommodations. A new documentary tells the emotional story of the activists that led the determined effort to achieve equality and accessibility that culminated in the passage of the ADA. It's called Change, Not Charity, the Americans with Disabilities Act. I spoke with one of the producers behind the film, Westerly filmmaker Hillary Steinman. This story goes back, you know, decades beyond the passage of the ADA. It's a reminder that to make progress sometimes in our system, it takes time. And I'm wondering what you think about how that could go towards helping young people today as they're fighting for what they believe in, to remind them, hey, sometimes the fight is going to be a long one.
Exactly. I mean, I found this film very inspirational in that if you look at how polarizing politics are today and how it seems like nothing can be accomplished in the current political environment, and you look at just, you know, 30 years ago, politicians on each side of the aisle came together for something for the greater good. And they had very, very different motivations. On the Democratic side, it was all about civil rights. On the Republican side, it was all about getting people off of welfare rolls and about independence and about how if we do this, even though it costs money, you know, for small businesses to put in ramps or to make different things accessible, you're going to bring more customers into the store. As you mentioned, it took a long time. There were a lot of stepping stones to getting the groundwork set for the actual legislation to be worked on in the 1980s. But prior to that, when things seemed hopeless, when there were no rights for young people or adults with disabilities, you had parents, the parents movement, who got out there in the trenches locally and started fighting for their kids and saying, my kid deserves a right to education. My kid deserves a right to be able to work. My kid deserves a right to be able to enter a building, or all the things that we all take for granted. And everything that led to the ADA started locally and with parents and built into a national movement. So I think that's really inspiring for today when it seems overwhelming. How can we fix some of these huge problems we face?
Do you think people with disabilities face less discrimination than they did at the passage of the act?
I think that if you look at the world today in the United States, I think that there is more opportunity, but it's fragile. And it's frightening because all of the things that people fought for, they're very fragile. And so while there have been huge advances, especially in educational opportunity, people with disabilities are still the most underemployed, you know, minority group in America today.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
The one thing that has stuck with me, you know, with the making of the film is that one of our participants said, we're all just temporarily abled and we're all going to be disabled at some point in our lives, probably, if we're fortunate to live long enough. And now, you know, every time I text, every time I, you know, roll my roller bag, you know, up a ramp or across a curb cut, or, you know, you're in an airport and you're reading closed captions, I think, you know, the ADA benefits me every day. And, you know, whether you have a disability or not, we all benefit from this. And I think people think that things for special interests are just that, for a narrow, you know, group. But actually, the Americans with Disability Act has benefited us all every day.
I've been speaking with Westerly film producer and director Hillary Steinman about her new documentary, Change Not Charity, the Americans with Disabilities Act. Hillary, fantastic film. Really, and a history lesson that we all need. Thanks so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
You can find a link to the film as well as more episodes of Artscape at thepublicradio.org/arts. Artscape producer James Baumgartner joins me now to share a few tips on what to do this week. Hey, James, what's going on?
Well, the Atlantis Rising Sandcastle competition is this weekend. 10 artists from all over the world are competing for prizes. You get to see fantastical creations made from sand. There's also activities for kids like Pirate School, musical toadstools, and the Bubble Fairy. Atlantis Rising is at Ninegret Park in Charlestown Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And this Saturday is the first full waterfire lighting of the year. It's in honor of the RISD commencement. The vendors and performances start at 7, and sunset is a little after 8 p.m. That's along the Wenasquatucket and Providence Rivers from Water Place Park to the pedestrian bridge. And Lewis, what's our favorite musical instrument here at the Publix Radio?
I'm going to say either the kazoo or the trombone.
Well, I like to think that it's the cello. I used to play cello. We've had several cellists on staff over the years, and PVD Cello Fest is this weekend. There are concerts Friday and Saturday evening at Matthewson Street Church in Providence, as well as a string of performances on Saturday from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Providence Public Library. This will include an old-time jam session, a jazz and pop group, and Red Velvet Vengeance, a cello ensemble that plays heavy metal arrangements. There might also be some classical cello mixed in there as well. And I know that Yo-Yo Ma is in town to play with the Rhode Island Philharmonic on Saturday, so who knows? Maybe he'll stop by to Cello Fest to jam with them. You never know. That's PVD Cello Fest this Friday and Saturday.
A lot of great stuff. Thank you, James.
Thanks, Lewis.
Let's hear a little Yo-Yo Ma as we end the show. The Weekly Catch is a production of the Publix Radio. Our assistant producer is Joe Tasca. Our producer is James Baumgartner. Our editor is Murray Valindo. Our chief content officer, Sally Isley. And our president and CEO is Pam Johnston. I'm Lewis Hernandez. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.